Blog Talk Radio.
Another great episode we have here at Suspense Radio. I'm your host, John Robb, and we want to thank everyone so much for joining us today. You want to talk about a killer show, literally, we got one for you. Coming up first is going to be author Lisa Unger. Next, we are going to have author Joshua Graham, Robert Dugani, and then we're going to finish out with lawyer, writer extraordinaire Marcia Clark coming back. So sit back, relax, enjoy, because 2 hours of Suspense Radio starts right now. So again, everybody, welcome back. I have to tell you that she didn't write "You're So Vain About Me," but maybe, you know, this one, thank you so much. So anyway, we're going to jump right on here with our first guest, author Lisa Unger. Her book, Heartbroken, has just come out June 26th. We're very excited to have Lisa back on the show. So Lisa, thank you so much for joining us, and how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, John.
Wonderful. So welcome back again. I believe we had you back when Blackout came out.
Yeah.
But now we're on Heartbroken. Book just came out June 26th. You're doing a lot of press. You're out there doing a bunch of stuff. So tell everybody a little bit about the book, a little behind-the-scenes action, and give them a little taste of it.
I will. It always starts, every book starts for me with some kind of a germ. It's something, it could be a news story or a line of poetry even, or a photograph. I mean, really anything could sort of get the zap on my head a little bit. And in this case, it was a couple trips that I took. First, it was a trip to an island in Canada, in Georgian Bay, Canada. And the next trip was to a place in Alaska called Ketchumak Bay Wilderness Lodge. And both of these places were notable for just the wild natural beauty, just the amazing, quiet, and pristine nature of just these magnificent places. And I just felt so moved by the way, you know, it kind of disconnected you from the outside world and reconnected you to your own inner voice and your inner life and how gorgeous it was. But at the same time, you know, I kind of sensed this sort of dark undercurrent, like almost a primal undercurrent, and it was spooky, you know, in its total isolation. So it was really kind of a moving experience, and both of these trips were family trips. You know how family trips are, right? You know, they're always great until they're not.
Yeah. And I watched Vacation many times.
The isolation factor as well.
Yeah.
So those two experiences, you know, that was the initial zap or the germ for the novel. And then what I find is that, you know, as if it connects with something that's going on deep within me, mm-hmm. then I start hearing a character voice. And in the case of this novel, the first character I heard, the person who led me into Heartbroken, was a woman by the name of Birdie Burke. And she lives on an island, sort of part-time, but she grew up on this island that's been in her family for three generations. And she's a harsh woman. She's unyielding, but there's a tremendous strength to her. And she sort of belongs on this island. And everybody else that comes to it from the family comes with some sort of tangle of obligation. And, you know, they love it. And yet there's such a high price to pay for being there. And, you know, it's a powerful place in that way. It draws people back, and yet at the same time, people don't always love it the way Birdie does. So at the heart of Heartbroken, there's Birdie and there's two other women, her daughter Kate, who comes to the island every year out of love for her parents, but also, you know, really doesn't love the island in the same way that they do. And then there's another young woman by the name of Emily who is headed in that direction as well. She's disconnected from the family. She is, a girl who's in serious trouble. She's made some very bad choices and fallen in with some bad people. And these three women are on a collision course, or I wouldn't actually say collision course, more like they're about to intersect in some very ugly ways on this island setting. And meanwhile, you know, there's a storm brewing, of course. And
of course,
cell phone reception is horrible.
So,
and, you know, bad things are about to happen on Heart Island. And that's pretty much the layout for Heartbroken.
So when you're talking between Kate and Emily and the Birdie Burkes, all three together, can the reader kind of assume that these three heads are going to collide in some way? Because, you know, when you look at the synopsis of the book, you know, it says that all three women are on a heart-wrenching collision course,
right?
Because there's some kind of terrifying history that has come back with the island. So,
yeah, I mean, and that's true in that, you know, Heart Island has, mm-hmm. you know, has some secrets of its own. It's a character as well. So they're all about to kind of connect in this place. I wouldn't necessarily say they're on a collision course, although of course they are, but there's...
Right.
Just this really sort of delicate interconnection between the three of them. Kate is, you know, obviously is Birdie's daughter. And so there's that dynamic, you know, mothers and daughters, you know, there's this tremendous love, but there's always, you know, the capacity for collision in that relationship. And Emily's connection to all of them is not immediately apparent. And it's what she thinks her connection to the island is actually different than what it turns out to be. So they're all coming to the island with secrets. They're
mm-hmm.
all coming to the island with consequences. They're about to face consequences for actions that they've all taken. And it's the place where a lot of these relationships are gonna come to a head. And so in that way, you know, it is definitely a collision course.
So the reader is going to be able to find out kind of these three women,
right,
and their backstories of
mm-hmm.
not only why they're there, but what exactly is their pull for being there, and
right,
what's going to end up, you know, what's going to end up coming. So you basically had to go and write, instead of, you know, a lot of people have to write, you know, one main character, you've
right,
in essence had to actually do three at once with backstories, with the whole emotional aspect all together. Was that
yeah,
something a little different?
No, at other points in my work, I have told stories from multiple perspectives. I have told stories from the first person perspective, which I love for its intimacy and its immediacy. But in the third person, you know, I mean, and this story is so big that it demanded, you know, multiple perspectives. And also, I mean, it's not quite a choice for me. You know, every story tells itself the way it wants to be told, and it's almost as though the story chooses its own voices.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this case, you know, I just felt strongly connected to these three women who are so different from each other. You know, they have so many, you know, it's like, and I was really interested about what happened when, you know, somebody like Birdie Burke, who is, you know, so upright and so, you know, in line and follows the rules and demands in, that other people also follow the rules and is so exacting. And then somebody like Emily who is, you know, just doesn't seem to have the tools to get it right. You know, she knows right from wrong, but she almost can't, you know, she almost can't just pick the right thing. She's always got to screw it up. You know, she just doesn't have what it takes to fly the straight course. So I was just really interested in how these two people collide. And then Kate is kind of, you know, she's just sort of the middle ground between them. And I could feel them all sort of so clearly, you know, like Kate's made mistakes, but then she's corrected and she's a compassionate person and a loving mother. And she's got this really, you know, she's a writer and she's got this story that she's told. And she has to, you know, tell her mother that she's finally, after so many years of, in Birdie's perspective, her not doing anything, you know, she's finally done something. And yet, you know, she's going to be revealing secrets about their family that even Birdie doesn't know. So it was such a big story that, you know, these three voices were, you know, they each demanded their place in it. So it wasn't sort of a confusing or a chore or anything like that. It was very much so the way the story demanded to be told.
Now, again, and then it also is that, you know, raw emotional power. Is that something that when you set out that's one of definitely your goals when you're writing the book, is to make sure that there's a strong emotional connection, whether positive or negative, between maybe your readers and the characters' interaction between them within the book?
Well, it's a really interesting question because, you know, when I sit down to write, you know, like I have this zap, right, this germ, and then I have this voice. And they're both really compelling. I mean, the feeling that brings me to my keyboard is it's a compelling, irresistible urge. And when I sit down to write, I don't have any idea, generally speaking, what my book is about, who's going to show up, what they're going to do day to day. And every day is sort of a mystery for me. I'm not sure who is going to be there and what they're going to want or what they're going to have to say. And, you know, in a great sense, I write for the same reason that I read, because I want to know what's going to happen. And that's how I write each novel. But I am always very emotionally involved. And the situations that I wind up writing about very often involve a kind of aspect of domestic danger. So there's a strong family element to all of my books, and also a strong element of, you know, suspense and fear and, you know, something stalking. And there's always this kind of, you know, high drama, only because when we talk about our families, we're always talking about raw emotional power, and we're always talking about drama in some way or another. And, you know, when we take that, you know, that really sort of basic human connection to our families, and then also there's the element of crime or something awful has happened and you're seeing everybody on the worst day of their lives pretty much. That's, you know, the emotional power is, you know, inherent in what's happening to these people, because every plot, you know, to me flows from character. And
now,
so, you know, these characters' lives are very rich for me.
And now, without giving away anything in the book, do you feel that there's more to tell with maybe one or two of the characters that are in the book that you'd like to explore further in another novel, maybe bring one of them back? Now, you don't have to say anything about who, of course, if anything happens to one of the three, you want to make sure that people are still surprised. So is there something to that effect? Do you still have maybe some untold story between one of the characters or two of them?
You know, it's hard to say. At this point, I would say I'm not positive. In the past, I've said, no, I'm never going to see that character again. And then, you know, a month later, I'm writing about him.
Right.
And so it's hard to, you know, say at the end of the story which character voice is going to continue. But I will say that there's a cameo in this book from a character from earlier novels. And he is certainly a character with whom I intend to go on, because I just cannot get him out of my head. So, That's, you know, and that happens, you know, certain characters, even from my earlier works that I wrote, you know, as Lisa Michonne, the four books that were published by St. Martin's and are now being reissued by Random House, even those characters pop in sometimes because there's something about them that, you know, they occasionally have, you know, something important to say and they show up. So I have, you know, I have an open-minded relationship about my connection to my characters, or an open-minded idea about my connection to my characters.
Now,
could,
the
any
thing,
of them could turn up.
Now, and the other thing also that kind of fascinates me whenever you talk about authors, because you have about 50 ideas that run through your head at any one time. You know,
right.
Authors are always thinking. You could be on the bus. You know, I was just on the bus not too long ago, and this literally happened to me was, I got on the bus, a guy looked at me and he goes, I really wish you'd buy my luggage for me. And I go, that's like the oddest question I think I've ever been asked on the bus. But that's one of those things that's like, you know what, I got to use that in a story. Because
right,
that's
I mean, that
so
is a great
odd.
Premise. It really
yeah.
is a great premise for a story. You're on a bus, it's like, I need to buy, you need to buy my
you know,
luggage.
What, yeah, it's
okay.
Like, what's in this luggage? That's
what's
stuff,
in
you
the
know,
luggage, of course.
But
and then, of course, the minute he steps off the bus, he has to be killed.
Right. And so the thing is that it's like, you know, so when you're sitting here and you decide, okay, I'm going to write, you know, the book, and I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with Lisa Unger, and lisaunger.com is the website. The book is Heartbroken. But how do you decide? How do you filter all the ideas out into your head to say, all right, it's time to write Heartbroken? Because, like I said, you probably had this idea for quite some time. But what's your thought process to say, now it's time to let it out?
Yeah, you know, I wish I had the answer to that because, I mean, I feel like it's so compelling. Like, when I hear the character voice that demands the page, there's no resisting it. And I can see my, and then when I've stopped writing for any given day, I'm still thinking about that character and what's going on. And during that time, I may have a million ideas in any given day just because that's the way my brain works. I mean, you know, I mean, the things that go through my mind are just, you know, they're terrifying. I'm sure nobody would want to be in my head all day.
Yeah, me too. No one wants to be in my head.
You know, which is probably why I write the kind of things that I write. You know, it's almost like an exorcism. You know, I'm exorcising all these demons that sort of dwell within me. But, you know, there's really, you know, and there may, you know, sort of be another story that's simmering, and I may occasionally be compelled to work on it, and there may be a point in which there are two stories that I'm working on at one time. But one story, one voice always muscles its way to the top. And even if my mind is constantly churning with ideas, there's only one story to be told for me at any given time, and I can feel it in my, you know, I can feel it everywhere. So it's not, you know, it's never a competition. You know, there's the one story always muscles its way to the page.
Yeah, and that's kind of like I said, the interesting thing, because right now you probably have 17 or 20 different ideas running around, and I know you're either working on your next one, you're in the middle of it, you already have a draft done of it. And just
yeah.
try to understand, like, you know, because you have a lot of young writers, and there's a lot of new writers that are coming up all over the place. You probably hear the questions. And and I guess they're just getting confused into figuring out, you know, they might have seven novels going at once, and they just don't know how to figure out, this is the one that I need to work on. And it's almost like you said, it's just a feeling that you get.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, an interesting thing for a young writer to sort of focus on is the first thing is to shut out of your head any idea of what is publishable. Like, as a writer, especially as an untried young writer who wants to write a novel, you shouldn't be thinking about trends. You know, you shouldn't, you know, one moment being like, oh, I'm going to write the next 50 Shades of Grey, or, oh, I'm going to write the next, you know, vampire book.
Right.
You know, you should be, and I think that a lot of people have those ideas in their head because, you know, publishing is something that people think about a lot more than they think about writing.
Mm-hmm.
And for a young writer, somebody, an aspiring writer, what you need to be thinking about every day, which is what I think about every day, is how can I be a better writer today than I was yesterday? How can I tell this story better today than I told it the day before yesterday? And if you focus on that and you focus on the true story that's within you, the true character voices that are within you and are demanding the page, and stop thinking from an external perspective of this could publish or this might sell, then I think you might find that there are way fewer ideas and much better writing in your future. I feel like writers, you know, aspiring writers are very concerned about being published, and I strongly believe that the most important thing you can do is work on your craft, get better at what you do, read everything you can read, and write every single day, and the rest will follow. Publishing should be, you know, an incidental pursuit to the pursuit of getting better at what you do.
You know, that's an interesting thing, and let's just say that there's a story or a book that you really want to write, and maybe your publisher or whatever is like, you know, we really want to have one of, you know, a book like this, or we really don't think that's a good idea. With the fascination of ebooks, will you just say, fine, I'll just write it on my own and publish it ebook wise on your, you know, yourself?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the future holds for ebook publishing. I've always been very fortunate in my relationship with my publishers. I've always been very fortunate that I'm, you know, pretty much allowed to write whatever I want to write. And the support of a traditional publishing house is something that you really cannot be underestimated. Yeah, I mean, if you have a story that you have to write and, you know, you can't find a publisher and you want to self-publish, that's a very different thing than it was, you know, even just 5 years ago. There's a lot more opportunities for people to sort of eschew the traditional publishing route and to go it on their own. And, you know, that's all, that's a choice that people have. But for me, you know, I've always felt very fortunate in my relationships. I've always had great editors and great publishers. And, you know, the support of those companies has made a big difference to me. So I'm not ready to, you know, go out on my own at this point.
So to get a little off topic, and again, we're speaking with New York Times bestselling author here, Lisa Unger. Her book is Heartbroken, just came out June 26th. LisaUnger.com is the website. So what's on your DVR right now? Since you're on the road and you're out there and you're going on, you know, you're kind of going on tour and you just kind of finished up with Minnesota and, you know, you're running around, what are you DVRing? So when you kind of get back home to relax, what are you going to watch?
Well, I have a couple of shows. And, you know, isn't it almost like, you know, that the best stories are on television right now?
Yeah,
it's
they're very
it's
good.
Kind of an amazing shift. I have just loved The Killing on AMC.
Oh.
I'm a huge fan of Mad Men. I'm an absolute, you know, fangirl for Game of Thrones.
Oh, you know, that's
a
whole nother thing.
Honestly, that show
pissed me off so much when he's funny. I'm telling you. Now we got to wait, 10 more months for it to come out again?
Ten episodes
in one season? Are you kidding me?
I know. You know, when it ended, I started the books because I thought, oh, my gosh, they couldn't have even scratched the surface of these characters.
No, they didn't.
And the books are amazing. I mean, I'm just in awe of what he has been able to do. I mean, I'm in awe of George R.R. Martin. I really, truly am. I've also been watching on HBO Girls. Have you watched that?
Oh, my God. Well, you know what? Yeah, I know, because that's the stupid show that comes on before Game of Thrones.
Yeah, Girls is
so
actually...
I always get the last 5 minutes.
It is great. You should give it another chance. It is like, it's literally some of the freshest writing that I have seen on TV. I mean, she is so to the bone. I mean, she just bears all. In the
yeah,
series,
they do
I think
do
she's
that.
A tremendous
I'll give
yeah,
you that.
Body and soul, right?
Yeah,
I just think it's such great writing. I mean, and that's, you know, obviously, and great character. Even in TV, you know, maybe especially in TV, character is king. You know, like on Mad Men, you know, Don Draper is, you know, maybe one of the best characters ever. You know, just so deep and twisted and dark, you know, within this, like, very, you know, pretty facade. So there's, you know, there's just so much great stuff on, there's so much great stuff on television
yeah.
right now.
Well, I got to tell you, I'm into the new Dallas. I love
oh,
the old
you
Dallas.
Are? How is
I
it?
And I love the new Dallas. Because,
ooh,
well,
I gotta
you know,
watch me some Dallas.
the good thing about it is that if you like the old Dallas, and they did it so well, it's because they brought back JR, they brought back Bobby, and they brought back the original cast members, and they just moved it forward 20 years. So it's so it's not like a 90210 or, you know, like a Melrose Place where they kind of forgot about the original and then they just try to start it and then that's why that show crashed. But 90210 keeps going because they brought back some of the originals and they put them into the front and a lot of people still like that. So they captured new audiences. But you kind of love the Dallas.
Oh my God! Yes, I can't. I totally forgot that we need to watch that. We definitely do.
Yes, gotta watch the Dallas.
Yeah,
I mean,
it sounds great.
And that always makes me think is that as an as an author, kind of wrapping up, is it more difficult for you in the books to write drama or comedy when you're trying to kind of fill some stuff in with some characters? Is it tough for you to make a comedic character or more of a dramatic character?
Yeah, I'm just not funny. You know, I don't even try to be funny.
See, now that was funny.
I'm funny when I talk, but when I write, I'm not funny. I don't even try. I mean, I've had people, because I do a lot of speaking, say, oh, you're so funny. Do you write funny books? No, I do not write funny books. They are very dark, and and they are high drama, and, I just don't even try. Although I think some of my characters have like sort of a natural funniness to them, and I hope it finds its way onto the page. You know, kind of a chuckle, endearing kind of funniness. But I don't ever even try because I just don't think of myself as being a funny person.
And it's a difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. You got to try
to. Some people just do it so well. Like Tim Dorsey and
Carl Heisman.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Lisa, I want to thank you so much for coming on today. It's been such a pleasure to have you. Again,
thank
the book
you.
Is Heartbroken. LisaUnger.com is your website. Is there anything else real quick that you're going to be that you want to let people know appearances? Are you going to be on any blogs or any other radio shows for them to hear or see you?
I think that if you just look on my appearance page, you'll see where I'm going to be over the next 6 weeks on LisaUnger.com. Just go to appearances, and and I'm also on Facebook at author Lisa Unger, and I'm interacting there in real time with all kinds of people. So that's the best place to find out what's happening next with me.
Wonderful. Well, again, Lisa, thank you so much for coming on, and we will talk with you later. Excited to see what we got coming up next for you probably around the same time next year.
I will really look forward to talking to you, John. Thanks so much.
All right. Bye-bye. Have a good one.
Bye. You too.
Okay, everybody, again, LisaUnger.com. The book is Heartbroken, came out June 26th. You can find it wherever you normally buy books. So get out there, get your summer reading stock up because school's out and you better be reading. We are going to be back here with our next guest, Joshua Graham. He's going to be talking about his book, Dark Room, which comes out, and of all the other things that Joshua does, because he's one of the hardest working marketing guys you'll ever meet in writing. So in the meantime, we're going to have a little music here. We'll be right back. I need to get a drink because when I talk a lot, I have to drink. So I'll see you in a second. So I want to welcome everybody back. Again, I want to do a big thanks to Lisa Unger, who was just on to talk about her book, Heartbroken, lisaunger.com. Go check it out. We are going to walk right in here now to our next guest. Author Joshua Graham is his name. His book is Dark Room. His website is joshua-graham.com. He's got a very interesting story, which we're going to get into. But, Joshua, we want to thank you so much for joining us today. How are you doing?
Great. Hey, John, it's great to be here, and I really appreciate what you are doing for the entire community of writers and readers, Suspense Magazine, Suspense Radio. It's just an awesome thing. I had the honor of meeting you a couple of years ago, and I'm just full of admiration and gratitude for what you're doing, not just for me, even though that's you guys have done so much to help promote me. I really appreciate that. But, I mean, just for, in general, the readers of suspense novels and thrillers and get a chance to talk with people and hear about people, get the inside scoop from authors. And then for the writers, I mean, what a great venue to talk about our books and talk about our lives and just kind of connect with your audience. It's just a fantastic thing that you're doing for the industry as well as the community. So I just want to say thanks.
I want to thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it. That's one of the main reasons when we started about 5 years ago, it has been over 100 radio shows to make sure that, you know, we just try to capture as many fans as possible, because there's so many fans out there and there's so many new authors that are coming in. It's just the consumers have to understand, how can I best spend my money? And if they don't really hear from the author about the books, it's going to be very difficult for them to say, yeah, I'm going to pump $25 down on your book.
That's really true. I mean, we're in a day and age where people really have to count very carefully what they're spending their money on. But it's not just the money. It's their time.
It's their time, it's money,
right?
Yeah.
It's an investment of time. It's also... Excuse me. It's also an investment of emotion, because if they're going to read a book and spend, if they're an average reader, spend like a few weeks with a book maybe, then they're going to want to make sure that it's worth the ride. And sometimes you can get a feel for that if you already know the author. But other times, you know, before you read 300 to 500 pages, it kind of helps to get to know the author themselves, so that you get an idea of, you know, what this person's like. Maybe I'd like to hear what he has to say or what she has to write. So your radio show, the magazine, is a great way for people to get to know the writers.
Well, and speaking of getting to know the writers, your book, Dark Room, this is your first, I guess you want to say, traditionally published book, picked up by Simon & Schuster on the heels of Beyond Justice, which was your last book. So, Dark Room, tell everybody a little bit about the book, a little behind the scenes, some character information, and kind of how, you know, the conception of how you kind of get it together.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a lot to say about it, so I'll try not to be too lengthy, but at the same time not to be skimpy on the details. You know, starting from the very beginning, I had finished Beyond Justice, and I was ready to start the next book. And at that time, I was just tossing around different titles in my head. Not to say that, you know, a title is going to necessarily dictate the next book I'm going to write, but I always liked to think of catchy titles, because besides the cover, one of the first things you notice about a book is its title. And if it has a catchy title and a good cover, you might be willing to pick it up off of a shelf and turn to the back and start reading about what this book, you know, is about. If you don't get past that point where the customer or reader doesn't want to even bother picking it up or just passes it by, then you're sunk. So to me, a catchy title is important. And the word darkroom just popped up into my mind, because I thought, well, it's got a nice double meaning to it, because it kind of hints at the word dark. And then there's this thing about the dark room being, you know, a place where you, at least in the old days, you know, where you would develop pictures and under, like, developing solution and all that. And I used to do that with my brother. We were like amateur photographers, and he had taken a big photography class when he was in high school. And one of the things I remember about that was, when you develop pictures of people in the darkroom under the safe light, as the white contact sheet starts to turn into an image, before it becomes a fully recognizable image, it almost looks like a negative. So the people's faces actually look like skulls and skeletons before they actually become real. And I always remembered seeing that. No matter how many times I'd seen that, it would, like, make the hairs on my neck prickle, and it was like a creepy, eerie feeling, but it was like one of those type of thrills that you want to close your eyes, but then you cover your eyes and you peek through with, you know, through your fingers, because it's
right.
kind of creepy, but at the same time you want to see it because it's kind of cool. So at the time I had been influenced a lot by Stephen King's writing, and one of my favorite books of his is The Dead Zone. And so in that book, you've got a person with precognitive abilities and all that. And I thought, well, what if somebody could see images in the dark room as they're pulling up? Like, say they take a picture somewhere, not realizing it was the location of a crime scene. And while this person is developing the pictures, the picture itself, the subject is normally there, but then they see, like, ghostly images that you can't really see in the natural, and they give you that kind of precog type of thing that tells a story that nobody in the natural can see. Basically seeing visions that help kind of uncover crimes or uncover secret things. So I thought, well, there is a cool premise. So from there, I decided to, you know, create a character. And so basically the premise of Darkroom is that you've got a photojournalist who, her name is Sandra Carrick, and she has these abilities to do that very thing. She doesn't realize she has the abilities until a little bit early, you know, through the first third of the book or so, but basically she, through these things, she uncovers a crime which uncovers a conspiracy, a 40-year-old conspiracy that people are still willing to kill for. So in doing that, she becomes the woman who knows too much, because she doesn't understand what these images are as she starts to investigate, and she, you know, really should have left it alone, but she's not that type of person. She wants to find out the truth and get to the very bottom of it. As she digs deeper and deeper, she starts to realize that she's gotten involved in something that now people want to kill her for, because they want to keep the secret covered up.
So now, while you're explaining what it sounds, and it's always fascinating to me, because I always like to figure out, you know, authors kind of where their mindset is, whether, and I always call it the chicken with the egg scenario, which is it the plot or is it the character? And it sounds like that you developed the plot before you developed the character. Is that your normal kind of MO on how you put books together, as you figure out what you want to do, the plot, and then you kind of start creating the characters that you know are going to fall within that?
Yeah, it's a fine line. You know, it's hard to say which one came first. You know, in this case, I think chronologically, yes, the title and the high concept came first, but that just was stored in the back of my mind, say, hey, you know, that would be a cool idea to write one day. But when I actually started to plot out the book itself, it started with the character, I mean, the story. Because, you know, you have the high concept, that's one thing. You know, the cool idea, the thing that sets this book apart from any other book is that whole, the high concept there. But then you have to have a story. And for me, the story started with a character, and this character basically had to be put into the high concept. So, okay, she's got this ability, and she's got to have to be involved in some kind of conspiracy. And since Darkroom has so much of a thematic tie to photography, I had to find some kind of conspiracy that would be at almost a global level, but at least a national security level or something like that. So I needed to find some kind of thing that maybe was old enough, because this character has a father who is also a Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist. And what could he have – and it has to do with uncovering some secrets using his old vintage camera. So what could be old enough that would require her to be going into an old-fashioned darkroom with a vintage camera? That's how I came up with the idea that, you know, her father was a photojournalist. Couldn't be World War II, because, you know, he'd be too old and she'd be too old. But then the most recent thing was the Vietnam War. So that's where that came from. And so, you know, it starts with the high concept, then it goes to the character. From the character, it goes to the plot, and it kind of goes spinning around and around. But, you know, this is the madness that has some kind of order in my head when I'm actually writing a book. So to answer your question, it sometimes starts with one or the other, but they're just interwoven. That it, at some point, you know, if you were to take a rope and say, okay, which strand started first? Well, if you were there, you might know if you marked it. But when you look at it, it's almost like you can't figure out which started first. They're all so tightly woven.
And I want to remind everybody here, we're speaking with author Joshua Graham. We're talking about his latest book, Darkroom, came out from Simon & Schuster, which is another story we're going to get into. It's Joshua-Graham.com is his website, to be able to find out all the stuff that he's written so far. So speaking of this journey about Darkroom, because you do have a very fascinating journey, and I always call you, and when people always ask me about, you know, marketing and whatnot, I say that you're like one of the hardest working writers in, I guess you want to say, you know, showbiz, because of how you had to start from the beginning into now where you are now, that hard work and dedication does pay off. And explain, and what I'm going to do is explain a little bit about, because you started off, you know, self-publishing, and you had to go out there and you had to get your name out, and you had to get people to read it and review it, and then all of a sudden, bam, now you were Simon & Schuster. How did all that dynamic kind of come together? Did you ever think that that was something that was going to happen? Was that even your goal when you set out to start writing? Or was your goal just to say, you know what, I just want to write because I love it. If people read it, that's great. If they read more of it, that's even wonderful. But your end goal was maybe not to get with like a Simon & Schuster, just to get as many fans or stuff as you had, and just to be able to write great stuff.
Well, even before I started to publish my early stuff, I had in mind that I wanted to have a career in writing. And my dream had been, you know, I had a day job. I was working in IT, and that was a job that I had for over a decade. And even during that time, I had sold some short stories to Simon & Schuster Pocket Books and made a couple of small sales. But I realized that, you know, this would be my dream career. I really would like to do this full time. But at the same time, nobody's going to walk away from a decent paying job with benefits and insurance, especially when you have a wife and kid and, you know, family to support.
Yeah.
So nobody in their right mind would just go ahead and walk away from that. But I always dreamt that, you know, it would be great one day if I could be doing this as my career, because I love it so much. Well, what happened was that I had the choice made for me when my company decided to outsource my entire department. So all of us, about maybe 12 of us, maybe a little bit less, we all found ourselves without jobs. And so there I was, of course, sending out resumes and hoping to get another job, taking interviews. But at the same time, my wife and I talked about it, and we thought, you know, since you love writing so much, Joshua, why don't you just go ahead and while you're looking for another job, just devote yourself to it full time. But in order for us to do that, we had to really cut corners. So we sold our nice big house and moved it, downsized into a rental, changed our lifestyle to fit around to doing this. And what happened was that my first novel, Beyond Justice, was independently published, as you mentioned, and it got some nice reviews from Publishers Weekly. And also got the next nice review came from none other than Suspense Magazine. And these things really boosted its popularity. But at the same time, the Kindle just came out. I mean, the Barnes & Noble Nook just came out,
right,
on the tales of the Kindle. And, of course, you know, but the first things that came out in my mind was like, okay, well, here's a chance for me to maybe get it published as an e-book. So when that happened, people started talking about it. And it just was one of those kind of like perfect storm things that the people on Facebook were talking about it a lot, and it just started to go kind of viral. And then people were first recommending it, doing rave reviews on it. I think one of the things that made people like it so much, especially the female readers, was that the cover model on Beyond Justice,
yeah,
they say he's like really hot. I was like, I had no idea. This is just a guy who looks like he fits the part of the protagonist. He's a guy in a suit and he's in behind bars. But they were saying, some people were saying, like, oh, I'd buy this book just to look at the cover model. It's like, okay, cool, that works for me. eventually, it started hitting the bestseller lists, and I started getting quite a bit of a following. Of course, you know, when you said hard work, it was fun for me to do this type of marketing work. I didn't really think of it as marketing as much as I thought of, you know, I want to tell people about the book because, yeah, I'd like them to read it. But I'm also like, oh, wow, people are saying nice things about it. So I would start, you know, sharing that on Facebook and Twitter and that type of stuff. And the next thing you knew, I had grown a bit of a platform. Now, mind you, at the same time, I was still sending queries for my next book, which was Darkroom, to traditional publishers. And it got its fair share of rejections, maybe about 40 or so rejections. But it finally got picked up by Simon & Schuster, the Howard Books imprint. And I firmly believe that it has to do with the fact that I had a track record already with Beyond Justice. I had some achievements and you know, a measurable following as well. So aside from it being a book that they felt strongly enough to get behind, I think, you know, in the publishing industry, there's so many departments. It's for Simon & Schuster, you have the editorial department, which is the first to decide to give you a chance or not if they think this is a book that they, is worthy of publishing. But then they have to go into the boardrooms and talk with the sales department and the marketing department, and they're the ones who are going to make the final decision, saying, okay, we can publish this book because we think it's sellable. You know, the editorial department can love it, but if the sales and marketing, they don't think it's sellable, then you don't have a contract. So I'm pretty sure that the sales and marketing department took a look at my track record, my sales history, or with my previous book, my platform of how many Facebook fans or Twitter followers I had, and I'm sure that all has to do with it. So my thought about this is that there are some people who think, well, you have to do independent publishing only and forget about traditional publishing. And there are others who say, independent publishing is just vanity publishing and it's not worth anything, so don't bother, just keep trying to get an agent or keep trying to publish it with a traditional publisher. And I'm not one to be on either one of those extremes. I think that the two different venues of independent publishing and traditional publishing, not necessarily in every case, but at least in my case and in some other people's situations, I think they can work symbiotically, that they can help each other. So I know that, what I bring to the table to my publisher is more than just, books that that they can sell, but I also bring in my kind of experience in business and marketing of my own work, because really, unless you're going to be like John Grisham, who's got huge marketing budget behind them, you as an author have to be your own marketer, and you have to be the driving force behind it. And if you have no experience with that and you just leave it all in the hands of somebody else, well, you're taking a big chance, and the big chance is that you won't get your book any exposure. So that's kind of a long journey to where we are right now.
Yeah, and the one thing that I picked up, of course, with everything is it sounds like you did this without an agent also.
That's correct. Yeah,
it can be done. Now, I don't know if you had to go back and redo it, whether or not you would do the same path or whether or not you take another one, but the good thing is that people have to know that it can be done. It just takes some time, it takes some effort, and it takes some patience. But it's ultimately your writing is what shines through.
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, you can have everything else that I talked about, but if the book is not something that, and I think your previous guest talked about working on your craft, if the book itself is not something that is of the best quality and your best work, then even if you have all the marketing experience and Facebook followers and Twitter fans, it's just not going to get past the gatekeepers. And those gatekeepers at the traditional press are your acquisition editors. They'll look at your query, or they'll even look at your synopsis, or maybe they'll even look at your full manuscript. But if none of that is up to par quality-wise, then you can't get past the first step, and then they won't offer you they won't even bring your project to the boardroom where the big decision makers decide to offer you a contract or not. So absolutely, first and foremost, you have to work on your craft. And the other part that, if let's say you're one of those people who says, forget about traditional publishing, I'm just going to indie publish myself, well, that's fine too, but with all the marketing and everything, you might be able to get a nice flash of sales for your first couple of months, but then will that book continue to sell? If the book is a really good book, I think years it'll just keep selling for years. If the book is like, okay, it was fun and not really memorable or forgettable, then the only way you'll be able to sustain your career is to write a lot more books and keep writing them, and even if they're not of great quality, but enough that people will buy, you can kind of do well. But if you really want to do well, you do keep writing a lot of books and make them all really, really good, then you'll do fantastically well.
And again, we are speaking here with author Joshua Graham, joshua-graham.com, and the book is Dark Room, to go out and get right now. It's been out for a little bit, and so since it's been out since May 1st, a couple months now, have you been getting some, preliminary feedback? Have you been getting a lot of fans emailing you back? And if you have, kind of, what's the one kind of theme or question that you seem to be getting a lot of or emotional response that they've been getting back to you on?
Yeah, I actually have been getting a lot of feedback. It's great because almost every day I'm getting some email or something through my website. People use the contact form and let me know what they think. And there are quite a few different things, but I think what people really enjoy is the fact that this book has ties to historical background, like the Vietnam War, And so there are multiple plot threads going along, multiple timelines. And the other thing I think that they've enjoyed is all the plot twists and all that. But they also enjoy the emotional ties of the characters that are involved. I mean, there's the father, I mean, daughter-father relationships. There are relationships between people who are not necessarily going to become romantically involved, but are resisting it. But it kind of happens anyway. And I think one of the things I did with this book was to try to really ground the reader in the setting. And in doing that, you know, some of the things I've heard from people saying were like with the opening chapters, which are taken in the Mekong Delta in Vietnam. There were a lot of the feedback were saying like I really felt I was there at the moment. And so, you know, I'm enjoying the fact that my readers are enjoying it, but I really appreciate it when they do like send me emails and give me feedback and let me know how I'm doing. It's been really encouraging.
Now, is there one character that's in the book that kind of has a bigger voice or turned out to be a little bit different than when you first started getting all this put together, you know, was a little different than what you had thought was going to happen when you started writing the book?
Well, different in terms of...
Kind of turned out to be a little bit, maybe had a bigger role than you thought was going to happen, or you ended up using them a little bit more than, you know, like you thought, just because of how the book started going. You're like, well, this character would be perfect to go with this scene and to keep moving forward. Did that kind of happen with you? Was there that surprise character?
There were. I mean, you know, one of the things that surprised me was that the killer, the assassin in this book, I didn't really know what was going to happen with him. He gets the opening scene in the prologue, and you get an idea of him. I had a slight idea that I didn't want him to be a cookie-cutter villain who was just all evil, evil, evil. So it kind of ends with him showing him that he's a killer who's reluctant, and that he's even got a bit of a conscience. You know, in this very opening chapter, he's disposing a body, and...
I love that.
Maybe I could just read you.
Disposing of bodies.
Yeah, he's trying to get rid of a body, trying to sink it and bury it in a pond in Central Park, and now he's accomplished what he has to do. And here's the last two sentences. He's saying, "I'm well on my way home now, into the warmth of Nicole's embrace, and to kiss Bobby as he dreams of ponies and puppies. Good Lord, what have I done?" And so he's a killer who's got a family. He's got a conscience. He loves his wife and son, and he's like, "What have I done?" Now he's not like, you know, psycho or anything like that, but you'll find out later that he's trying to leave this assassin life behind him because he's such a great assassin. He's been used as a, you know, for high level political things, and now he's being used again. But it's almost like, wait, why is he doing this if he doesn't want to do it? And so this person, his character, I always wanted to have a villain who does bad things, but also can do good things and can also have redeeming qualities about him. So there's an internal conflict of he's doing horrible things, but deep down he could be a good person. And so that took a kind of a surprising twist that I didn't realize he was going to have as big a role in this book as he did, even to the very end. So that was probably what you're talking about.
Well, wrap it up here in about 45 seconds. Tell everybody a little bit about your radio show that you have going on with Susan Wingate, because that's another thing that you do.
Yeah, okay. Well, this is called Dialogue Between the Lines, and it's also on Blog Talk Radio, www.blogtalkradio.com/dialogue. And, you know, the truth is we were inspired, Susan Wingate and I, by you, John, because this was such a great venue. We decided we wanted to try to, you know, reach out in our direction to do that. So we've actually got we've had some best-selling authors on our show as well. We've had J.A. Jantz, we've had Lincoln Child, Jerry Jenkins, some really, you know, big names.
I think
Steve
you just
Barry.
Had Steve Barry on.
Yeah, Steve Barry. So yeah, we do this every Thursday, 10 a.m. Pacific time. And our podcasts are there. We have a website, www.dialoguebtl.com, where we try to you know, announce things that are going on and our links to our podcast archives. So, yeah, it was basically inspired by what you're doing, and we just hope to one day do as well as you are doing.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. So, well, Joshua, I want to thank you again for coming on. The book is Dark Room. It's joshua-graham.com is the website. Look forward to see what you got coming up next. Stay in touch with anything, any news, notes, anything that you want to let us know about, and we will talk with you shortly when the next book comes out.
Thank you very much, and I'm looking forward to, I guess you're going to be at Thriller Fest in July 3rd.
We're actually not going to be there this year. We're taking a year off, and then we probably will be back next year. But, yeah, we're going to be down in Anaheim at the end of July for the festival down there, and that's about as far as we're going to stray from L.A.
Okay. Well, then I hope to see some fans out there, because there will be little book signings, and I'll be on a panel with Daniel Palmer called Is the Apocalypse Imminent? So,
nice.
July 13th and 14th in New York at Thriller Fest. So hope to see everybody there.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Joshua. You have a great day.
You too. Thanks, John.
All right. Have a good one.
All right. Bye.
So again, everybody, that's author Joshua Graham, joshua-graham.com, and the book is Dark Room. Go out. Go get it. Again, it's a fabulous read, and we just wanted to again thank Joshua for coming on. We're going to be back here in a couple minutes with our next guest, Robert Dugani, talk about his book, Conviction, and we will see you in a second. Hold on. So welcome back, everybody. I want to thank you again for joining us. We are now going to go on our second hour. I want to thank again Joshua Graham and Lisa Unger for joining us here previously. Again, lisaunger.com, joshua-graham.com. Go check them out. But now we're going to move on here to our next author who came out with his book, Murder One, and now we're going to talk about his latest book, The Conviction. Robert Dugani, how you doing? Thank you so much for joining us.
John, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so, again, Murder One came out, was voted one of the best thriller books of 2011. Got to be happy about that. And then you went ahead, and now you're back with The Conviction. So tell everybody a little bit about The Conviction, because when you look at the cover, you see handcuffs with blood. That can never be a good thing for somebody in a book.
And I tell people it has nothing to do with the success of Shades of Grey. Handcuffs on the cover.
Yeah, really. Yeah, we don't need to talk about that book on this one. Even though when I interviewed Laurel K. Hamilton, it sure was a lot of sex talk that we talked about, but that's a whole different story.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The Conviction is the fifth book in the David Sloan series, and it's really always very amazing to me because I never intended to write a series. When I wrote The Jury Master, I fully expected that would be a standalone book, and in fact, I'd already written another standalone book called Damage Control, which got printed, and I was ready to move on. I thought I was done with David Sloan, and then when The Jury Master hit the New York Times list and people were excited about him as a character, and my editors came back to me and said, geez, we'd love to bring him back. You have more ideas, you know, kind of things started rolling. But, you know, in all honesty, the good series writers understand that writing a series is an art. I just like writing a novel has a beat to it and structure to it. So does a series. And I really felt like I reached my stride when I hit Bodily Harm because I do something in that book that's really very dramatic, was upsetting to a lot of my readers, forgave me. But, you know, what it did was it really set up the series for me to write Murder One and now The Conviction. And The Conviction and Murder One are really, really a continuation of the storyline that began in Bodily Harm. And in The Conviction, it's really a story about Jake, Sloan's stepson. Jake's in trouble, you know. All the stuff that has happened in his life, that happened in Bodily Harm, the loss of his mother, are finally coming home to roost. And it's in the form of alcohol and drugs. And before he knows it, he's in some real serious trouble with the law. And what I really wanted was I wanted a book in which, you know, a lot of people can relate to it. A lot of young people can relate to it. A lot of parents can relate to it. And I always tell my own kids, it takes a lifetime to build a reputation. It takes one dumb moment to tear it down. And so I wanted one of those situations where Jake makes a really bad decision, and it ends in a really bad consequence. He and his buddy are thrown into a mountain boot camp. And David Sloan is, of course, you know, the knight in shining armor. He's going to ride to the rescue, only this time he finds, number one, Jake doesn't want his help. And number two, he's in an area with a bad judge and a bad system, and he can no longer use the law, which has always been his lifeline. The law can't help him. And so he's got to take matters into his own hands. And it really raises that question for all parents, you know, how far would you go to save your son, to save your child? And, you know, knock on wood, John, the reviews have been really, really strong. AP gave it a great review. The L.A. Book Review gave it a good review. Tucson picked it as the book of the summer. And a lot of what people are identifying with is this whole concept of, you know, a parent and a child and their relationship, and what do you do when you got a kid that's, you know, going off track, and how far do you go to try to save them? It's been really, I'm very grateful because people seem to really be understanding this book and enjoying it.
Yeah, you know, being a parent, you have to always say, you know, we read hundreds and hundreds of books of different killers and everything else like that. And sometimes you just kind of, you know, as a reviewer in a magazine, you just kind of get a little bit immune to, you know, the death and everything that goes on. But when you hit something at home, like you are, you know, like a parent, it brings you back to a point where you actually have a really deep-seated fear. And I think that that's kind of what books are supposed to do. They're supposed to give you the satisfaction of not only, you know, and this is going to sound really cool, but, you know, the satisfaction of scaring the hell out of you, but being fictional to be able to maybe let those emotions out, but knowing that it didn't really happen to yourself. Do you kind of agree with that?
I absolutely agree. I mean, what we're trying to do as authors is we're trying to reach people in those places, you know, where we all live, you know, all those little nooks and crannies that scare us. I mean, some people do it by, you know, there's a person in the closet, and they're going to jump out at you. Some people do it. I was just listening to your previous guest, and he sounds like he's got a great book. You know, you got someone that's killing people, burying bodies, and really as a thriller writer, what you're trying to do is you're trying to get people to suspend their disbelief, but in a way that makes them still believe that what you're writing could actually be happening. And the best emails that I get are the ones where people will say to me, did this really happen? Is this a true story?
Mm-hmm.
And in this particular instance, it's not a true story, obviously it's fiction, but you know, part of the genesis of the idea came from the story that arose out of Pennsylvania, where you had two judges who were accused and convicted of sentencing kids to a private juvenile detention facility for profit.
Oh, that's right.
And we're getting kickbacks. And once I saw that, I said to myself, you know, I already kind of had the idea. I said to myself, oh boy, here we go. Because I have gotten quite a few emails from readers saying, you know, didn't this really happen? And I'll have to say to them, you know, the book is fiction, and the boot camp is completely fiction. The judge is fictionalized, but yes, it can happen. And it was really funny, John, because this is the first book I've ever written where it was premised upon true events that were so unbelievable that I almost had the opposite effect of I was worried people wouldn't be able to suspend their disbelief and believe that this could really happen, because the story out of Pennsylvania was so unbelievable. I mean, how could these two judges get away with this for so long? I mean, where were the parents of the children being wrongfully sentenced? Where were the defense attorneys? Where was, you know, this? Where was that? Where was the public outcry? And
right.
It wasn't. And these people got away with it for 3 years. And you know, so I it was really, I mean, I've only gotten one review that wasn't really very positive. And it was basically, well, it's hard to believe these events could happen. And the reviewer obviously didn't realize that, in fact, these events did happen. So it was really interesting, dilemma I kind of faced when I was writing the book. I mean, you know, how do you write true events so that people believe they're really true?
Well, you know, the state of Pennsylvania just recently has been known for covering up a lot of things and let people do things for quite some time without busting them. So I guess it's not out of the realm
point.
To think the judges could do it, too. But,
no, you made a good point.
Yeah, no, and we're speaking here with author Robert Dugoni, my fault. See, I knew I was going to screw it up once.
That's all right.
RobertDugoni.com, D-U-G-O-N-I. The book is Conviction that we're talking about right now. It's the third book in your David Sloan series. So how has your character David progressed now, through the three books? And has it been kind of the way that you thought? Have you been able to explore a little bit further than you thought you were going to be able to when you started writing, the series?
Yeah, I guess kind of two answers to that. The first is that I got a review out of Chicago one time that really pleased me, because the reviewer said that, in his opinion, David Sloan was the most well-developed character since Rusty Savage in Presumed Innocent. Now, that's a great compliment, except Scott Turow was able to develop Rusty Savage in one book at the time, and it had taken me three books at the time with David Sloan. But, you know, what it pointed to, John, what I've tried to do in these books is I've tried to make Sloan a real human being. I mean, you know, he does have an incredible ability in the courtroom, but I didn't want him to become a superhero. And so what I'm trying to do is put him through all the things that we all experience in life, you know, love lost, children behaving properly, children behaving wrong. It goes well at work, it goes poorly at work. All the things that we experience in our life, I'm trying to have David Sloan experience. What's interesting is I just got an email the other day from a reader out of Kansas who said there was this scene in Murder One where Sloan sits down and talks to a priest who's a friend of his, more than a confidant. And the scene really, really moved that individual. There's a line in that scene where it says there's a difference between love and need. A person who loves you will always put you first. The person who needs you will put themselves first. And I swear to God, I have no idea where that line came from. I mean, it's one of those things where I'm not that smart, and I have no idea where that came from. But you know, it was one of those moments that writers have where you're writing and you're in the moment, and the muse is talking to you, and you just let it talk. And that's kind of where David Sloan has begun to go for me. You know, in the first book, the jury master people would say to me, "Are you David Sloan?" And I would laugh and say I was never that good an attorney. But in many ways, I was David Sloan. In many ways, you know, I think we write, writers, you know, characters are of us. They come from us, but they're of us. And so every character in a writer's book comes of them. Whether it's the good guy or the bad guy, you know, my bad guy is going to be different than another person's bad guy because I have different fears than another person's bad guy. But what I have noticed is that I don't identify with David Sloan as the books have progressed. I actually identify with other characters in the book, and that's partly because David Sloan has no family. David Sloan has no faith, and that's completely opposite of who I am. And so it's, you know, David Sloan has progressed in a way where he's really become his own character, his own person, if you will, independent of me as a writer.
And that's one of the things that a lot of authors, I think, make a big mistake, especially up-and-coming ones, is that I think that you have to, as an author, you have to put some of yourself within your pages to make your characters believable and real. And kind of the only way to do that is to kind of draw on your inner emotions and the way that you kind of are yourself in order to, you know, how would this character react, you know, if somebody spilled coffee on them in Starbucks on accident, you know, what are they going to do? Just those little reactions, just those little things that, you know, readers maybe miss or maybe they catch on to, but then when they get it all together, then it makes sense.
Yeah, no, I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, the characters have to come from us, right? They have to be, they're of us,
yeah,
as writers, but they also have to be independent of us. And you have to allow them to develop, to become their own persons again, you know, if you will. You know, for instance, when I wrote the ending of Bodily Harm, I did not write that ending. I wrote the book up until like page 350, you know, 360, probably five times before I wrote the ending. And I thought I knew the ending I wanted to write. But what I began to realize was I couldn't write the ending because it wasn't the ending that David Sloan wanted me to write. It wasn't the ending that David Sloan would have done. So, you know, like you mentioned, spilling coffee in Starbucks. You know, I'd probably get up and say, you know, hey, it's okay, I'm fine. You know, it was an accident. Everything's okay. Another person might stand up and say, you know, you idiot, how did you spill coffee on me? I want your business card. I'm going to sue you. And so mm-hmm. you have to respect that people are going to act differently. David Sloan in the end of Bodily Harm was not going to do what Bob Dagoni would have done in that situation at the end of that book, in a custody hearing with Jake. Was, you know, he wasn't going to do it. And when I finally came to realize that, I wrote the ending, and it's probably the most powerful ending I've had emotionally in any book I've ever written. And the same was true of The Conviction, you know. What would you do? How far would you go to save your child? And anybody who reads that book, what it really does is it forces them to examine their own heroism, if you will. You know, how heroic could you really be? I mean, if you're being honest with yourself, okay, how heroic could you be? Would you be willing to, you know, break the law? Would you be willing to arm yourself? Would you be willing to, what would you be willing to do? Or would you, you know, basically go to the judicial system and say, hey, you know, you're supposed to help me, or go to the police department. But what do you do if you can't go to the police department? What do you do if you can't go to the judicial system? And I think that's what's kind of affecting people, is that it's hitting them in that one of those core questions inside of all of us, which is, gee, we know we love our kids, but how far would you go to save them?
And do you think that as yourself, that you answered that question on a personal level to yourself? Or did you make your character go further than maybe even you would go?
Sloan goes further than I ever would have gone. I came to this question, John, when I was watching the movie Blood Diamond years ago.
I remember that.
I'm watching this African man, you know, travel across war-torn Sri Lanka, the area in South Africa.
Where they've
made, you know, these boys into boy soldiers, and they're all armed, and you have an army, and, you know, he's going across the country. They're getting shot at. They're nearly, I mean, all the things that he's doing to try to get to reach his son. And I remember watching that movie, and my palms were sweating. And my palms were sweating because I was saying to myself, I don't know that I could do that. I don't know that I would have the courage to do that. You'd like to believe you did, but, you know, more of us would be more inclined to go to the embassy, go to our senators, go to our, you know, congressmen and say, you know, you got to help me, because that's kind of what we've been programmed to do. I think it takes a special breed of person to do the things that man did in Blood Diamond and that David Sloan does in The Conviction. And it's no different than when you sit there and you see people, somebody that goes and climbs Everest, or somebody that decides to trek the Amazon rainforest, or better example, decides to row across the Pacific Ocean by themselves in a rowboat. I mean, I would no more do that. Than
dude, that sounds so freaking fun right now. That sounds so fun, I'd do it.
Yeah, see, and it's like, you know, we're all different, but we all have to ask those core questions of ourselves. You know, what are you really willing to do?
Well, I mean, without a doubt, and we're speaking here with Robert Dugoni, robertdugoni.com. The book is The Conviction. But, you know, when you're writing a series, do you find it difficult that, you know, you have to keep going back to keep everything together to say, okay, what did they do in Bodily Harm? What did they do in Murder One? I can't mess up because my fans are going to rip me if it's like, no, I said his favorite color was blue, and now I just said something about yellow, or this and that, back and forth. Do you have to have, like, a big page of notes that you can flip through and go back and say, okay, what is this, to make sure that you kind of keep it all together? Or does it just kind of flow naturally where you really don't need to do that after so long because you just start to know the character just kind of like they're your best friend?
Yeah, no, they're, you're definitely right. There are little things that you have to pay attention to. What color are her eyes? What color is his eyes? What kind of car is he driving? What kind of car, you know, is she driving? You know, there's little things like that. But what I've really found is that every book has to stand on its own. Every book has to be its own novel because you can't anticipate that people are going to pick up a series at the first book. I have many, many readers. I just got back from Dallas and did a bunch of events in Dallas, and I had many people that would come up to me and say, you know, I've never read you before. And they say it almost apologetically. And I'll say to them, well, this is great, because now I have someone that will hopefully like this book, The Conviction, and you'll have four other books in the David Sloan series to go back to and enjoy. And so what I try to do in the series is, and I actually, Steve Barry and I talked about this once, I really try to make it a book that if someone picks it up for the first time, has never heard of me, has never heard of David Sloan, never read one of the prior books, they still can enjoy the full experience. They can still put the book down and say, I read a complete book, and I understand it, and I get it, and I understand the ending, and everything fits. Now, they may go back and begin reading from the beginning of the series, and they may find a few inconsistencies, but for most of the readers, I think what they're really looking for is a book that will give them satisfaction, that when they put it down, their questions have been answered, the story has been satisfactory to what the writer set out to do in the beginning and developed in the middle of the book, and they've had a good, enjoyable experience. And so I've kind of gotten away from going back too much to my prior novels. I did it. I made the mistake of doing it in Wrongful Death, and I put a couple of seeds in Wrongful Death about what happened in The Jury Master. And the people that had read The Jury Master were just frustrated. Why are we going back? And the people who had read The Jury Master were just confused. What is he talking about? So I just came to the conclusion that what readers really want is a separate story unto itself, and that's really what I try to do.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I agree with that because you just never know, because you want people to go out and buy The Conviction even if they hadn't read you before, so then they can go back and read it. So even though you do write a series, and a lot of people, I think, get that misconception where 90% of the series, the books are pretty much standalones as you go on. Now, of course, you can always go back and find out, you know, more information. But even when you're, you know, watching a movie or something to that effect, you're never seen from birth to now. So there's always a time when you can always go back and kind of figure out, you know, what happened. And that's the thing that I think a lot of readers have to get over and say, oh, my God, now I have to go back to the beginning. Well, you don't technically have to go back to the beginning.
No, and again, you raise a really good point. When a reader opens up a book, right, they open up to a page in a character's life, and that character is fully developed on that page. I mean, you don't know what their background is, where they went to grammar school, or where they went to high school, whether they're – you just get the character at that moment. And I think that's one of the fun things about writing. I think that's one of the fun things about being a reader is that, you know, it's almost like you're – that's the question that's raised. Who is this person? Why are we here? You know, your prior guest had that powerful opening scene where the guy is trying to sink a body in a pond in Central Park. You know, I mean, any reader who picks that up is going to go, why? Who is this guy? What is he doing? Why is he doing it? And that's really what you try to do as a reader. You don't try to write an opening that is overdramatic or that has purple prose or that just is over the top. What you try to write is a beginning, an opening page that raises a question. And that's what you try to do.
You know, now, when people are going on your website and they're going to see a lot of stuff, you know, you have a lot of things on there. I mean, you got your newsletter, you got everything going on. And the one thing that you have on there that always intrigues me is that you have something called classes and seminars. Now, what exactly are, you know, encouraging authors or authors that maybe have written but are just trying to get over that hump? What are, you know, what can they expect if, you know, if they go to like a seminar, you know, kind of how do you help them out? The things that you probably weren't able to get going up, but you're kind of giving back now.
Really, it's the practical. I teach practical. I tell people when they come into my classes, and I now teach all over the world. I just got invited to teach in New Zealand. I've taught in Mexico and Canada. What I teach is practical stuff. If somebody comes into my class and says they're looking for one of those experiences where I'm going to massage their neck and tell them to imagine the waves crashing over them, and when they feel good, then they can start writing, that's not what I teach. What I teach is you put your butt in a chair. Writing is hard. You know, you put your butt in your chair, and here we go. And what I try to teach is the practicalities. What are you trying to do on that first page? Why are you trying to do it? What are the four or five things that you're trying to do in your opening? Establish the tone. Introduce your protagonist. Make them sympathetic or empathetic even better. Hook the reader. You know, there's things that you learn through the mistake process. I liken writing a lot to baseball because baseball is the sport of failure. If you get 3 hits out of 10 at-bats, you're a great player. And it's not unlike that. It is, and it's not unlike that in writing. You know, if you write 5 manuscripts and you get one of them published, you know, you're doing pretty darn good because then one of them, you know, you'll go forward from there. But it's trial and error. You have to fail in order to learn how to do it right. And I failed a lot when I got started because, you know, part of it was just ego, John. I mean, part of it was this thought, well, you know, I wrote for the LA Times and I was a lawyer. I mean, how hard can it be to write a novel? Well, I learned it's very hard to write a novel, to write a good novel anyway. And what I learned was, you know, through my rejection letters from agents, from editors, was I had to get better. And so I started to really study the craft of writing. And the good news for young, new writers out there, aspiring writers, is that it is a craft. And if it is a craft, it means it can be taught. Now, someone could teach me how to build a house, and I could go build a house. It would probably be a really lousy house, but I could build the house. And
right.
So what I always tell people is, you know, this is a line that Steve Barry once said, and I agree with him wholeheartedly. He said, I can't teach you how to write. I can only teach you how to teach yourself how to write. Because at some point,
right,
after you get the structure down and what I'm supposed to be doing and how I'm supposed to be doing it, it's going to come down to how do you put words together on a page. And that's where the true art comes from. So you can learn how to write a novel, but it's going to be, you know, your artistic ability then that's going to separate your novel from somebody else's.
Absolutely. I mean, it's always fascinating just to be able to see and hear when you go to Thriller Fest and you're able to talk to the people that, you know, you read and they're telling you basically how to do it. I always find that great. Again, we're speaking here with author Robert Dugoni, and the book is The Conviction, and robertdugoni.com is the website. And, you know, a little off topic here, and like I kind of like to know, you know, do you guys go around so much around the world? Like you just said, you're going to New Zealand. Maybe that's an event we should cover for the magazine. And you're going around, you do so many things. So what is on your DVR? You know, how do you kind of keep up with what's going on in the TV and the entertainment of everything that's happening?
Well, I'm an escape artist. I love watching TV because it's my escape. When I write all day and I get home, you know, people say to me, what are you reading? And it's like, look, if I'm writing, I'm not reading. If I'm traveling, I'm reading. If I'm on planes, I'm reading. And when I'm out promoting, I'm reading. But I love television. And so this sounds terrible, John, but I'm a huge sitcom fan. I love sitcoms.
Oh, wow.
I think sitcoms are incredible vehicles for writers because what are the really good sitcoms? The really good sitcoms are nothing more than character development. Every single character has to be unique in a sitcom. And how do the writers of sitcoms make one character different from the other? And you know, right now I'm a big fan of The Big Bang Theory.
Oh, my
and,
God, I was just going to say, I've been watching all of them. This freaking show cracks me up.
It's fabulous. And the reason it's fabulous is because they're all different. Every character on that show has a unique quirkiness, a unique thing to them, And even the physicality of them, if you watch Leonard, he's always got his fingers together. And it's just so
yeah.
it's this quirkiness. And we as writers can really learn a lot from people that write television sitcoms, because they are the good ones are genius in how they bring a character to life through just a small little twist. You know, they're all nerds, but they're all different kinds of nerds. And so
yeah.
I've always been like that. I mean, all the way back to All in the Family. You name a sitcom that, you know, Taxi, Cheers, Everybody Loves Raymond, Seinfeld, all these sitcoms. I love them. I love watching them. I get a kick out of them, and that's my escape. That's my little thing.
Wonderful.
And I hate to admit it, but that's what's on my DVR.
You know, that's on my DVR too, because I'm trying to go back and watch all of the Big Bang Theories, because I kind of didn't get into it until actually they were already in season 5, because I just never have enough time to sit and really watch TV, but I'm kind of making time for this. So
yeah,
Robert,
you and I are in the same boat.
Yeah, I mean, I want to thank you so much for coming on. It has been an absolute blast. Again, the book is The Conviction, with you nothing but the best going forward. We'd love to be able to stay in touch. You tell us what's going on in your writing life and everything, and we'd love to have you back on when we have book 4.
I'd love to.
Or whatever your next book is going to be.
Yeah, no, and if I can have 10 seconds, I'll just say, Murder One has been nominated for a very prestigious award. It's been nominated for the Harper Lee Award, which is given by the American Bar Association and the Alabama School of Law. And I'm up against Michael Connelly and David Ellis, two really, obviously, really great writers. But if you go to my website, you know, or you go to the ABA Law Journal and you put in Harper Lee, you'll see the public has the ability to vote. They get 1 of 6 votes. And boy, I'd love for people to go on there and give the Murder One some consideration. So, but other than that, John, thank you
well,
very
congratulations.
Much. It has been a blast. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, and congratulations on that honor, you know, and good luck.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Enjoy yourself. We'll talk to you later, Robert.
Bye-bye.
All right. So, again, everybody, that is author Robert Dugoni, and the book is The Conviction. It's, you know, he's the third book in the series. Robert is a fabulous writer. Another book that you need to have put on your Kindle or your Nook or your Kobo, whatever, and, you know, make sure that you have him on your radar here for the summer, because you don't want to miss out. If you haven't been able to, you know, read Bodily Harm or Murder One and The Conviction's your first, that's fine. Go out, get The Conviction, then go back, read Bodily Harm, Murder One, catch up on everything, you know, that he has going on with his character, David Sloan, and the progression. But, you know, he's definitely an author that you don't want to miss out on that needs to be there. So we're going to be back here with our next guest, Marcia Clark. Of course, you might know Marcia from the O.J. Simpson trial and whatnot, but she wrote a book back, and we had her on, which was Guilt by Association, her first fiction, and now she is back here with Guilt by Degrees going forward with her character, Rachel Knight. So we're going to talk with Marcia again. So in the meantime, give us about 5 minutes, listen to this, and we'll be right back with Marcia. Thanks.
An image of you and of me, and we're laughing.
back, everybody, and I want to thank everybody again for joining us. I want to thank author Lisa Unger. I want to thank Joshua Graham and Robert Dugoni, who we just had on. And now we're going to round the show off here with author Marcia Clark. And she was the author of Guilt by Association, her first fiction book with her character, Los Angeles DA Rachel Knight. She's back with Guilt by Degrees. She's amped up everything. And so, Marcia, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How you doing?
I'm good. Thank you so much, John. It's a pleasure to be back with you again.
Yes. And, you know, we met you last year finally in person. I think it was at the, I don't even know what it was called, but it was in L.A. At the library when you were signing, and we were able to talk with you there, which was great. And we got that copy sent to us by Guilt by Degrees. And so you kind of put Rachel in some more predicaments. How much fun are you having?
Oh, I love it so much, John. This is, you know, I think that when we talked last, this is a childhood dream come true for me. I always wanted to write fiction, crime fiction in particular. I was addicted to Nancy Drew when I was like five. So to be able to do it now, it's just a beautiful thing. I can't say, you know, it's really what they say about writing is very hard work. That's really true. So there's definitely a love-hate kind of thing going on. But overall, of course, the love is much more, much, much greater than the hate.
Right, and, you know, so you're a perfect person now to ask, because to see if the old adage is true is, everybody says that your first book is technically your easiest one to write because you had your whole life to do it. But then when you go to book two and your publisher says, I need it in 8 months, and you're like, oh, my God, I had never written a book in 8 months because this one took me a while. How was that dynamic to have to sit there and turn right around and put out Guilt by Degrees?
Well, you know, it kind of didn't work that way for me. Here's why. There's no question that writing the second book, once you start writing under contract, it's a whole new world. That's absolutely true. So you have time pressure that you didn't have for the first one.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of did have time pressure for my first one because I was working full-time handling criminal appeals. And that job is a really time-consuming, heavy-duty job. It was about 100-hour, 120-hour week already.
Jeez.
And so... Yeah, and I had taken a few other runs at the book in the prior years and then wound up with the first book. I did wind up having an agent interested in an earlier version of it, and the assistants worked with me for about a year taking notes, at the end of which they said, oh, it's not there yet, and I said, I agree. And then I threw the whole thing out. I said, you know what, I actually now know what I should be doing. So I threw the book out and started all over again. But doing that, knowing that I had to write the whole book all over again while working full-time, I thought, this is going to kill me. I'm never sleeping. I'm writing between midnight and 4 in the morning. And so I knew that if I didn't, I had like a limited period of time during which I could survive and get the book out. So book one actually had some time pressure to it as well. And I got it done in about 9 months and, you know, got lucky, and that was the one that got picked up. So when I was starting to work under the pressure of a contract, it was familiar and not so bad. Was there more pressure? Yeah, it's a different kind of pressure because now it's somebody else, not just me saying I'm going to die if I don't finish this.
Right.
So, yeah.
So Guilt by Degrees, like we were talking. So Rachel's kind of been, you know, now she's progressed out of the next one. So tell everybody a little bit about, you know, Guilt by Degrees and how you've kind of progressed your character Rachel Knight going forward. And, you know, the little behind the scenes that you have with the book.
Yeah. In Guilt by Degrees, I show a little bit more of office politics in the DA's office. I show more of Rachel's traumatic childhood to explain what her damage is. I think everybody in this world has damage of one kind or another. There's no such thing as going through this life without some kind of scarring and therefore what I call an emotional limp, if you will, that causes us to behave in manner in a way sometimes that is counterproductive, self-destructive. We have ways of getting in our own way as a result of what we've been through. So I wanted to show how Rachel's irrationality could surface and why, and explain, give you the background to show what her problems were. So I've rounded out her character to give you give a more full explanation of who she is, and then played it out in her personal life to show how that played out. How does her scar play out? In addition, I show in the beginning, in the very beginning of the book, how there was the book starts with the murder of a homeless man on a downtown street near the courthouse, and how people walk by that homeless man for hours while he lay bleeding on the sidewalk, dying, and took pictures of him, stepped over him, but did nothing for him. And by the time the police were finally called, he was dead. That part was inspired, just that one part was inspired by a true case in New York. I think it was in Queens, where a homeless man came to the aid of a woman who was being attacked by someone on the street. He saved her. She escaped and ran. He got stabbed. And he literally lay on the sidewalk bleeding out for hours with everybody walking right past him and ignoring him. And he died. I dedicated the book to him, actually. I took that one scenario and then pulled it out so Rachel sees, she's in court on her own case. Rachel is in special trials, which means she handles only the high-profile complex cases. The murder of a homeless man, sadly, is not that. So she's in court while a regular deputy is handling that homeless man's murder, and he's still called John Doe. They haven't even identified him. And she sees this deputy DA just basically dropping the case on the floor. He doesn't care. Who cares? It's a no human involved. He doesn't, you know, very cavalier. And he blows the case. And the preliminary hearing gets dismissed. And he's acting like he's not even going to try to refile the case and give it a chance. She gets furious. And she grabs the case from him, which pisses him off, and refiles it herself. Which engenders a fight in the courthouse, and a lot of things happen. And one of the things that happens is she's got her hand slapped, and she's in trouble already for you're not allowed to go pick up your own cases. You don't troll the courthouse. So
right.
She has 48 hours to work this case and see where it goes, and, of course, discovers that she works it up with Bailey Keller, and they discover that it's actually connected to the murder of a beloved police officer in which the defendant was his wife and she was acquitted. So those two cases are connected, and then we take it from there. In the course of this, Rachel crosses paths with someone who's going to become a nemesis for her, a sociopath who, not a serial killer. I don't want to ever write a serial killer book because I think they're, for so many reasons, but
right.
She's not So she runs into a person who is a real sociopath and is inclined to mix it up with her and is a real foil for her. So lots of new things develop.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's been fascinating that you've been able to do here in two short books is be able to complexity put a character like Rachel Knight, and you're showing the, you know, more emotional side, more humanistic side of who she is as a character. And like I said, in just two books, where a lot of authors, it could take four or five before you really see the roundness of kind of who your character is. People will get a fabulous sense to know who Rachel Knight is at the end of Guilt by Degrees. And was that something you did by design? Did you want to have that happen? Were you trying to maybe hold some things back to get, you know, things going forward? You know, how was that thought process when you started, thinking about Guilt by Degrees and writing it?
Well, that's a great question, John. I actually, from the very start with Guilt by Association in the first book, I thought, okay, I want to introduce Rachel to the world, but I want to do it in a realistic way, and I want to unfold her character in increments that make sense, that fit the character. So Rachel is a very guarded, private character who does not want anyone to know about her background, her history, and plays everything very close to the vest. So in Guilt by Association, you get a hint, but you don't get the whole thing because she wouldn't do that. She wouldn't let you know that kind of thing. She's not that character, the person you meet at the party who, after one drink, is starting to tell you about their their entire childhood, who they were trying to date in the ninth grade, and then their failed senior prom. She's not that person. She's the opposite. So when you ask her how she is, she's fine, and then she'll ask you how you are, and she'll probe you with more questions about how you are, but she's not going to talk about herself. In Guilt by Degrees, I thought, you know, how do we get to know this character? How would it really happen? Well, it would happen by accident because she would not allow it. And then I played it out from there. And so it happens that she gets kind of forced out forced into revealing herself to her friends, and that is how it would really happen with her. The degree to which we get to know her in our second book, Guilt by Degrees, is really a function of what happened, how it fell out. It was just kind of a logical progression in terms of, okay, if this happens, then that. And that's kind of how I like to play out both the plot and the character development of my characters, is think about what really would happen and then play it from there. Obviously, our stories in these crime fiction novels always are going to be more pulled out than a real case is. A real case is really boring, John. You know, Chewy gets mad at John and shoots him. And
I was on jury duty, and I'll tell you, I was bored to tears.
Yeah.
And if I was a homicide and an attempted homicide somebody was doing, and I was so flipping bored by the end of the second day, I'm like, oh, my God, this is not Law and Order.
Exactly. Especially for you. I mean, you know, you're a crime fiction expert. You know, you're
sitting there
for
going,
something.
Oh, my God, this is so not Law and Order.
This is, yeah. Or anything that you would ever read. And it's true.
Yeah.
You know, the real cases, if I was to write about them, you don't ever, that's why you don't see people writing about the run-of-the-mill cases, even with the nonfiction crime books. You see them write about the weird cases where man bites dog. And so our crimes, when we write fiction, are going to be much more complex, much more outrageous, much more on edge. They're more geared towards what is possible, what is the edge of possibility, as opposed to what is likely. And so given that, those kind of bizarre premises, then in order to give it authenticity, I like to play it out. Okay, given this bizarre premise, how would you really investigate the case? What would you do next? What would this character do? What would that character do? And give it the logic that gives it a balance of reality.
Yeah, I'm wondering who the first author is who's going to start writing about bath salts. because now that that's coming all together, who's going to start writing about bath salts? Because, you know, that's what we do. I mean, that's kind of what, you know, like I said before, I was on the bus not too long ago, and literally a guy looked at me when I walked on the bus, paid my money, and I was staying there because I was going to get off soon, and he goes, boy, I really wish you'd buy my luggage. And I go, what an odd question to ask me. You know, you just see it in everyday life. And I know that, you know, with all your experiences, you've seen that thing too. But like you said, you have to take the fact and turn it into fiction, and you got to amp it up. But when you're writing about, like you said, the political things at the book and what it is behind the scenes, how much of that is actual factual? So when people are reading it, they can get a sense to say, wow, I mean, you know, being in the DA office and the behind the scenes is really not as glamorous as maybe what people perceive it to be.
Well, that's for sure. I don't know that anybody perceives it to be glamorous.
When you watch Law and Order, you always want to, you know, you want to be like freaking, you know, Sam Waterston when you do his stuff, but it ain't like that.
You know what? That is so true. But actually, Law and Order, the original Law and Order, was very true to life. And that was why that's the uniquely one of the very few crime series on television that I really used to enjoy watching because it was so real. So that you know, makes – I think that gave people a real sense of the way things go, the politics that can be involved, and the way cases get handled in the upper management levels. My stories are all really pretty much inspired by the truth. They certainly start there. So is it a reality that the DA's office has office politics, backbiting, climbing on each other, envious co-workers, backstabbers? Sure, of course. I don't know of an office that doesn't have that to some degree.
Yeah.
And so to depict the truth of that in essence, yeah, I would say that my experiences certainly do inform the books, all of them. In specific, no. I'm not talking about specific people that you might go into the office and meet. I'm talking about types that exist.
Yeah, and I think that that's important for people to realize, too, is that there has to be, you know, a little bit about, you know, the factual to the fictional. But, yeah, you can't really get into too much in depth because then it's just kind of writing like a educational book.
It's boring,
and that's
right?
Kind of different too. Yeah, and it is.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're
speaking
here with author Marcia Clark, and it's marciaclarkbooks.com. The book is Guilt by Degrees. It's the second in the Rachel Knight series, which the first was Guilt by Association. But then you also wrote something else, which was If I'm Dead, and it was a Rachel Knight story. And was that, is that a companion to go along, or was that just a little short story that you that you wrote in order for fans to just get a little bit more in depth about what's going on?
Yeah, it's just a little short story. It's really just a little kind of, it's a folkloric crime story, trial story, that is, that we always like to tell. And I thought it would be fun to have Rachel actually involved in that story that involves a no-body homicide. That means we never find the body. And I've done a couple of those cases. They're rather rare. And so that I had to handle two of them was unique.
Wow.
But, yeah. And it poses its own unique set of problems. I think at some point I'd like to do a book that involves a no-body homicide because I think they're so interesting. In the course of doing a case like that, you have to, your detectives, and so Rachel also, has to go out and do what we call due diligence to prove
yeah.
that the victim is really dead. And that means they get to flesh out the victim's life. Where did they go shopping? Where did they eat dinner? And it requires you to build a portrait of your victim in some detail in order to show that they did nothing that they should normally have done had they been alive. So it's a whole different kind of focus on the case. In If I'm Dead, I took one of the stories that come out of those kind of bizarre cases, and it's just kind of meant to be a fun little ride, trial story of a ride. So it's not tied to the book. You know,
yeah,
particularly,
it's just something outside
and
of it.
It's just, yeah, it's just a little vignette kind of.
Yeah. Now, when you're going forward, now you probably have, you know, book three that you're thinking of, and this and that. Do you have a character either in Guilt by Association or Guilt by Degrees that you wrote that shocked you so much to where it's like, I didn't realize they were going to have this much of a voice. I didn't know that this character was going to come out this way, that you might bring back or that you're trying to expand on even further going forward in the Rachel Knight series?
Yes. There was at least one that I'm thinking of, but it seems it's funny to me that I wind up finishing a book and then there's some kind of character, usually a fringy criminal type character, that I like enough or I'm intrigued by enough that I bring him back for a cameo. And I did that with Guilt by Association, gangbanger Luis Revelo,
okay.
who is kind of an important figure in that book, comes back for a cameo in Guilt by Degrees, because I just loved him too much to let go of him. And he's going to come back in future books as well because he's too much fun. He's an upwardly mobile gangbanger who wants to get an MBA. And
yeah,
will probably wind
right.
up being the head of a big corporation.
Right. Like, you know, like a lot of politicians.
Yeah. Hopefully not like that. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
You never know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in Guilt by Degrees, there's a kind of a criminal gang type, a different kind of gang entirely, who winds up coming back for a cameo in my third book. So I find that these characters kind of get hold of my imagination. They kind of hook in there, and I think, I want to bring them back for one reason or another, whether because I really like them or I'm just really intrigued by them for some reason.
Now, when you're talking, you know, you're kind of laughing when you talk about the character, and it makes you, you know, more like it gives you that great sense that you have that great emotional connection. But is it more difficult for you when you're writing to kind of write, you know, dramatic characters and dramatic scenes or more comedic, you know, scenes in your book? Which is more difficult for you to maybe, you know, get through?
John, they're all hard. But, because I don't know, I mean, when you're saying that, I'm thinking, gee, is anything easy? Not really.
Well, easier.
Easier. You know what
yeah.
the hardest scenes to write for me are the traumatic, the sad scenes with the victims. When I write about the families dealing with the death of their, whether it's a spouse or a child or a parent or whatever it is, those scenes where we have to go, Rachel and Bailey go and Bailey is the detective that she's best friends with who is assigned to Robbery Homicide Division, which is the elite unit of LAPD, and they work all their cases together. Which is actually realistic because special trials prosecutors wind up with the high-profile cases, so they always they do wind up working with the same detectives over and over again. And if the experience is a good one, they start to seek each other out. so that you would wind up working cases with the same detective over and over again is not so far out of reach in terms of reality. The hard scenes, though, are when they have to go, or when Bailey has to go and break the news to the parents or the whatever, the surviving family members, because it's so sad and it's so tragic, and it was such an awful part of the job of being a prosecutor is dealing with the tragedy of why you're there.
Yeah.
So I think those scenes for me are among the very hardest to write because they're so painful.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, you know, it floods back a lot of those emotions that, you know, maybe you're trying to, maybe put in the back of your head, and then you have to kind of write them out, and it does probably bring you to that sense while you're writing that you have to kind of relive those things again, but then you can also use that as a positive, because then you can take that emotion and write it in your character, and then your readers really will get the sense and understanding of how difficult something like that really is to do, and make them stop and think, there's never a way ever would I ever want to be having to do that.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I think what happens so frequently, and I really, in my third book, I actually pointed out very specifically, because in the third book, we go to trial, so we're in court, and the thing that seems to happen very frequently in the course of an investigation and trial, everyone forgets about the victim. Everyone forgets that they once were living, walking on this earth, and they had hopes, dreams, fears, ice cream they love to eat, and movies they really want to see a third time.
Yeah.
And that kind of flesh and blood humanity of the victim gets lost in the shuffle. And so being able to show in these books how the family has suffered, the loss, the hole that gets torn in their lives as a result, it's really important to me, because it's something that the prosecutor uniquely has the most experience with. You know, the defense doesn't, judges don't, reporters don't. We do, because we have to deal with them, and the cops do, for sure, have to make the first notification. It's one of the hardest things I think those detectives have to do is deal with front line with the victims' family when they first make the notification. So to be able to bring that reality, it's good to be able to remind people of what's really at stake here. It's not just a fun puzzle, because this is a tragedy.
Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what, Marcia, you have done a brilliant job. We want to thank you so much for your Rachel Knight books. Guilt by Degrees is the newest one. MarciaClarkBooks.com is the website. Read Guilt by Association, Guilt by Degrees. Get yourself enthralled in Rachel Knight. You will not be sorry. Marcia, thank you so much for coming on.
John, thank you so much. And if people want to find me on Facebook or Twitter, my handle is That Marcia Clark, because somebody took my name. So it's That Marcia Clark now.
You know, it's amazing. Someone will take anything. I mean, not only will they steal the underwear from you, but now they just take your damn name and put it on Facebook.
Okay, wait, I haven't had my underwear stolen. I don't know about you. Wait, John, have you?
Maybe, I can't say that. Okay, so Marcia, thank you so much for coming on. We look forward to talking to you about your next book. Again, if you got anything, news, notes, or whatever's going on, you know, please keep us updated. We'd love to be able to share that with everybody. And if you just want to come on and talk about something that's happening in the world, let us know. We'd love to have you back on.
My pleasure, John. I will. You take care. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Enjoy your day.
You too.
Okay, everybody. That was author. I'm getting stumbled here. That was author Marcia Clark, MarciaClarkBooks.com. The book is Guilt by Degrees, the second in the Rachel Knight series. You will not be, you'll be so enthralled that, you know, you'll go back, you'll read Guilt by Association. If you haven't read that book already, you'll just get yourself enthralled. Another great series that you need to follow, emotional, raw talent right here with Guilt by Degrees. So we want to thank everyone that's been on our show today. It's been a jam-packed action show, fabulous powerhouse authors, New York Times bestselling author Lisa Unger came on to talk about Heartbroken. We had Joshua Graham talking about his book, Dark Room. Then we just had Robert Dugoni on, and he was talking about The Conviction. And again, Marcia Clark was on talking about Guilt by Degrees. We are going to be back. I believe next weekend, I always forget my schedule, so you have to kind of, you can find it out by going to suspensemagazine.com and, you know, clicking on the Suspense Radio button, and you'll be able to find out everything that we got coming up, because we have some fabulous guests again coming. We're going to take some time off after
some shows here, and then we'll be back. Our July issue is going to be out soon. July 4th is coming. I hope everyone has a safe holiday. If you want your four free issues, please email editor at suspensemagazine.com. We will send them to you for free to check all the stuff out that we got going on, where we follow everything in suspense, mystery, thriller, horror. That's the music. That's my cue. Again, thank you, everybody, for coming on. Thank you, all of our guests. Go out, get your books, go to the beach, wherever you're at, and start reading. Enjoy, everybody. I'm John Robb, your host with Suspense Radio. Thank you again. Have a good one.